Microwave Radio, please note that the content aired on this program is intended strictly for entertainment and educational purposes only and does not constitute financial, legal, or professional advice. The opinions, discussions, and views expressed by our contributors, guests, and associated Microwave staff are their own and do not necessarily represent the official stance, strategy, or opinions of the Microwave organization or any of its affiliates. While we strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, Microwave Radio makes no representation or warranties of any kind expressed or implied about the completeness, accuracy, reliability, suitability, or availability of the content of this show. Any reliance you place on such information is therefore strictly at your own risk. We do not endorse or assume responsibility for the accuracy or reliability of any information offered by third-party websites, linked through the show, or any website or feature linked in any banner or other advertising. We will not be a party to or in any way be responsible for monitoring any transaction between you and any third-party provider of products or services. All audio content of Microwave Radio is the intellectual property of the Microwave organization, and any use, reproduction, or redistribution of this content without the express written consent of the Microwave organization is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
Thank you very much. This is John Galt speaking. Welcome to Microwave After Dark. For some reason, the internet decided to take a skip. Maybe we're under attack by God knows who. Welcome once and welcome to everyone. This is a very interesting program because we're going to refocus on what has been happening the past week, plus what we're projecting to happen in the near future, and a repeat of 2006 to 2009 does appear to be in the cards. But without further ado, I want to welcome everyone who's new to the program, everybody who missed it last week, and who wishes to participate. Please speak up. We will sit there and invite as many listeners to participate in the program as possible. We're going to try and keep it tight to an hour. I'm going to just give a quick summary of what happened today in the markets because everyone's sitting here talking about what's new, what's occurring, what happened. Today, the markets were way overblown for their performance. We had an unemployment report this morning, non-farms payroll, which was nothing short of spectacular fiction. In fact, George Lucas could have written it, produced it, directed it, put it through Disney, and still attracted a lot of viewers and listeners. When you look at the breakdown of the market, with the Dow up 307, NASDAQ up 199, S&P up 57, volume was the lowest for the entire week of trading. It was a short squeeze. It was designed to sit there and force people into buying garbage stocks in the market when there was no reason or possibility of the market going up as interest rates surged and gold skyrocketed. I'll talk later on in the show about precious metals, but at this point in time, with everything we've heard from employment, I want to sit there and turn this over to Mr. Awesome, if you're ready, sir, because the truth is there's a credit crisis building in the background, and most people are not paying attention to it. We're not listening to the markets again. We ignored it in 06. We ignored it in 07. We ignored it in 08 until it was too late. And here we are again with the housing crisis coming back to get us on the backside, so to speak, of what was an unusual bubble created by a so-called pandemic that has forced people to invest in markets. Mr. Awesome, if you're ready, I would love to sit there and hear you take over on this because you really have an interesting perspective on what's going on with real estate and how this could impact credit markets.
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. I guess I'll start. I just posted a screenshot in the comments that caught my eye this week. As of the end of 2023, 38.5% of first liens in bank portfolios are adjustable rate mortgages again. And that's the ranging, according to In Mortgage Finance, 27% in Wells Fargo's portfolio and up to 43.9% for U.S. Bank.
Mr. Austin, for the new, just I hate to interrupt you, but for the new listeners, please explain what the ARMs are because a lot of people are new listeners. They're younger. They weren't around for the first crisis. Sure. And they don't understand how those particular mortgages function versus the traditional 1530s.
Sure. So an ARM is an adjustable rate mortgage. Now, there are different types and they're slightly different than they used to be. It originally came about in 1982 in response to high interest rates. And the concept of adjustable rate mortgage is that your rate actually can change and does change. There are certain periods where, depending on the loan type, it'll be capped at a 5-1, 5-year change, 7-year change, or they can just adjust with rates as you go. Now, there's also something called a temporary adjustable rate mortgage. And that is something that a lot of new home builders have been using quite a bit over the last, certainly the last 16 months to move homes. And that is where your first year, you'll pay one rate, second year, you'll pay a different rate, and the third year, it'll go to what the rate you qualify at. So basically get 2 years of reprieve from high interest, and then interest rate goes back up. So that's what an adjustable rate mortgage is. And one of the reasons why this caught my eye is because of a lot of the things that have been going on in finance. I'm also going to share a chart in the comments below that that is the percent of mortgages that used points buyouts. So essentially what that is, for anybody that is unaware, it is when you pay your lender to reduce the interest rate of your loan. And these could be permanent or temporary, but this is from the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and Freddie Mac, this map that I posted, showing each state and what their prime purchase borrowers paid for discount points. Now, prime being anybody with a 640 or above credit score. Now, unfortunately, they didn't publish the statistics on subprime percent of buy-downs, but one of the reasons why this is concerning, right, we've got this long history since the GFC of everybody being concerned about subprime mortgages and subprime adjustable rates. But the reality is that during the Great Financial Crisis, more than twice the amount of prime rate borrowers were foreclosed on than subprime. And I'm going to post a couple more charts in here from the Federal Reserve. One of these shows the share. So you can see that. John, I don't know if that's pulling up for everybody, but essentially this is the prime foreclosure starts versus subprime foreclosure starts. And the prime foreclosures way outpaced subprime. Now, their study goes on to show that depending on when the foreclosure started, that different credit rates had different timelines for recovery. And I'm going to share that because it's kind of an interesting concept that they even thought to go that far in the study. But essentially, right, The Big Short has kind of, the movie has kind of warped everybody's view about what really happened during the Great Financial Crisis. It was not a subprime credit crisis. It was really, we were heading for a recession. Recession made the situation worse, but somebody made a very public bet on credit default swaps that was notarized and later on, turned into a movie and a book. So there's a lot more going on than just subprime credit. But one of the things that I wanted to point out is just that these things are happening again. We've got adjustable rate mortgages. We've got mortgage buy-downs. We had published the 2023 Home Mortgage Disclosure Act information. Now, what that is we have these laws, right, where all of the lenders need to document who they're lending to, what that credit profile is like, their debt-to-income ratios. So in reviewing some of this information, for instance, the other day I just did a deep dive on Maricopa County in Arizona, and of the 72,000 refinance loans that were strictly for cash out refinances, 35,000 of those records didn't have the debt to income ratio in them at all. So it kind of defeats the purpose of having this program in place to say we're going to prevent bad mortgages from going out again if we're not actually following through on that.
Well, this brings up the next question. We were told God forbid I sit there and say that, that this was under control, that this would not happen again. God forbid I say that 15,000 times. And that the Federal Reserve, FDIC, and the Department of Treasury had everything managed to a point where this could not repeat. However, we know if anybody watched the credits for The Big Short or anything else, they still issue CLOs, which are collateralized loan obligations, CDOs, which are collateralized debt obligations, and CDS. If you would, real quick, explain what the risk is because of the reclassification of what a prime mortgage is versus a subprime mortgage, which really blurs the lines when you're looking at the data.
Sure. So it's, in essence, a lot of these products do still exist. They got rebranded, but they're essentially the same thing. Now, the CLOs are more for commercial. There's a lot more of that going on. Whereas with the mortgage-backed securities from residential, tend to be purchased by government agencies, Fannie, Freddie, the Federal Reserve has purchased a whole bunch of them. But the risk to these is that they're pools. So you might have loans from 10,000 different borrowers put into a pool of these CLOs, commercial mortgage-backed securities. So if, say, 10% of those start to default, then the value of those pools goes down, and it affects all of them. So, again, it's the same thing. They're layered where you might have, say, A-rating credits on one of these mortgage-backed securities, but not on all of them. So it might be a tranche. You have A-rated, B-rated, C-rated, they're all lumped together. So it's the concept was if you can mix the risk, then you're going to have less risk. But essentially all you're doing is mixing the good in with the bad. And a lot of this, again, it's not based on prime or subprime. Real estate is cyclical like everything else. We have a business cycle. The National Bureau of Economic Research dates, right, recessions, that's the end of that business cycle. Then when the country recovers, we have the next one. Real estate is the exact same way. And when people start to pay too much for something, whether that's commercial real estate or a house, right, you get to a certain peak and the expenses are going up. The expenses continue to go up. In the case of housing right now, what we have is we've got insurance going up. We've got property taxes going up. Same thing's happening with commercial real estate. Only with commercial real estate, the income portion is going down. And as we know, the job market, even though we had a wonderful headline today, we've got more people working two jobs than I think at any point in time.
So that's correct.
There's stress in the market. And while we might not be seeing the delinquencies in the mortgage market for housing just yet, there's also an awful lot of programs out there that are preventing foreclosures, preventing delinquencies. So it's not, you know, as rosy as everybody wants to think it is.
Mr. A, I'm going to bring the question up because this is a serious question. We experienced this during the 07-08 crisis, so to speak. The depression is really what it was.
Correct.
When that occurred in the past, we witnessed a reclassification of default from being the traditional 90 days on a mortgage to whatever the bank needed to do to sell the paper off against it. In other words, pawning it off on the government.
Right.
I think we're beginning to see hints of that becoming a reality again, even though the Federal Reserve is not buying paper openly on the market. From your perspective, and I think you've been a party, and folks, if you don't know, we have a private chat that we engage in simply to hash out issues of the day. And it's more so we can produce quality content on macroedge.net and present you the facts, things you're not seeing in reality. A lot of these derivative instruments that we were just talking about are still traded. However, they're traded in what's called a dark pool, off-market, private markets between individual lenders, hedge funds, gamblers, for lack of a better word. And they are not subject to open public pricing, so you can verify and validate the quality of the investment. There's no regulatory oversight. Dark pools have long been the nightmare that the Federal Reserve and the FDIC have feared, yet we still see no acknowledgement that that trading is going on. Your comments.
Yeah, well, it's problematic. We kind of have two different types of lending going on in the world right now. We have traditional bank lending, and then we have private non-bank lending. They're not subject to the same categories of regulation or opaque. They're more opaque than what you would have for a bank. So it would be really difficult to tell just what's going on with private lending and how well their books are doing or performing if you don't have any inside knowledge on that. I actually just posted another chart on some of those commercial mortgage-backed securities from CreditIQ. They do a great job tracking a lot of this stuff. And they just published that we've hit a record delinquency rate. So I posted a chart on that in the comments. And then I'm going to post another chart on different types of delinquencies so that everybody can take a look at that as well. But we're definitely seeing signs of stress in the market. Whether it's banks, right? Everybody's been watching what's going to happen with regional banks, what's going to happen with banks. We have no idea how to classify private lenders and how well they're doing. We've had some stories out there about how they're borrowing to cover the debts that they are paying, and who knows what's going to happen when and if that show stops, or if we do hit recession and we have lots of job losses. But it's not going to be pretty.
Well, Mr. A, I'm going to bring this back up because we're going to go full circle right back to commercial real estate. For some reason, the difficulties that are beginning to creep up in residential real estate are being glossed over as the economy is strong, everybody has a job, incomes are solid. We can debate the data later on in the show. However, with commercial real estate, it's fairly cut and dry. We've seen for lack of a better word, acceleration in the delinquency rates, the default rates, and the ability of commercial borrowers to make, meet, or refinance their notes. And with interest rates hovering between 5 and 6%, and by the way, folks, that's just the Fed funds rate. The real rate could be as high as 8, 9, 10% that a bank will only guarantee a refinance, and Mr. A can verify this, because the risk factors that are involved. Does that not introduce a substantial financial risk to the system? Because as credit becomes difficult for commercial borrowers, it becomes even more difficult for lower class citizens and lower middle class borrowers on the margins.
Sure, of course. If the revenue generators in real estate are not able to generate revenue and can't service debt, then they're not generating revenue, right? And then they're not employing people. That money that was counted on being paid back doesn't get paid back. So that affects the entire market structure as well. And that's the problem with the debt structures, where we start spending, we overspend, right, on speculation that markets are only going to ever go up, when we know that that's not, it's not possible. Yes, in the long horizon, right, they increase and they rise, but they can only sustain so much at a certain time, and then there's recession, right, a recession or a business recedes. So if you've got these lenders or operators of real estate that aren't able to make money and they're not able to pay back their loans, that's money that's supposed to be going elsewhere that's not going elsewhere. So essentially the wheels or the cogs of the system come to a grinding halt, and there's systemic risk anytime something like that happens. When you go back to 1990 recession, the real estate, commercial real estate, was absolutely decimated. And I posted a chart the other day. I'll come back to that in a little bit. But delinquencies for commercial real estate were worse then than they were during the Great Financial Crisis. And for years afterwards, there was vacant space. And we've actually, office space has actually broken the record, 86 and 1991's vacancy rate. So it's not a healthy real estate market in the commercial world at all.
So with this being stated, does this or does this not mean that we're doing the same thing we tried to do in 06 and 07 and paper over the real losses, where the markets are ignoring the depths of the problems and at the same time, for lack of a better words, allowing the deadbeats, and I hate to use that phrase because people have financial difficulties, stay in their homes. Stay in their homes despite their ability to pay.
If I could jump in to just
come on in, Ozark, please.
Yeah, historical parallel here. That if you think, I'll acknowledge I'm a bit bearish on the subject, but if you think of the history of the Soviet Union. And ultimately what drove the Soviet Union down was a misallocation of capital, a lack of free flow of information, and ultimately what did them in, of course, was a free flow of information where the population realized what a house of cards the whole thing was. And it's starting to look awfully similar as far as the interest rate cycles and this massive debt bubble that has exploded in the background is that, okay, maybe we don't have centrally planned factories and infrastructure and heavy industry being built, but this manipulation of the interest rate has created the cycle that I think Mr. A was about to describe in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good way of putting it, right? All of that, there's misallocation of capital. The low rates that we had for a long time really opened commercial real estate to different type of business structure, which was almost like rate trading, right? And for a lot of people that aren't aware of how some of these commercial operators work, right? There's they have an operating partner that raises money, they syndicate funds from people, and people invest. And oftentimes, the person doing the investing and operating, they're not even putting their money in. They're using other people's money, and then they're earning a percentage as time goes on. So we've got, you know, pricing in commercial real estate that, in my opinion, has been unsustainable for quite some time. And we're just starting to see the real downside of it. And commercial real estate is, in fact, in its own recession right now. Prices are coming down every day. But to your point before as well, we're extending, right? Everybody that can extend is extending as long as they can, but it's almost like they don't have a whole lot of choices if they are interested in losing money. They're extending it in the hopes that something changes or someone comes up with a way to fix the situation. But everybody runs out of rope at some point. So it's just a matter of time before it becomes a bigger problem.
So with that being said, KK or Kike, I'm not sure how to pronounce your name, so I'll just call you Double K for short, and welcome aboard to the MacroEdge team. My question for you is this. What are you seeing where you live, and what is your perspective on this problem? We would like to hear this.
Hi. You can just call me Kalani. My name is Kalani. I just had a question, actually, for Mr. Awesome. You mentioned at the beginning that the percentages of adjustable rate mortgages were up to 38% at the end of 2023. I'm just wondering, what were the percentages of adjustable rate mortgages leading up to the Great Financial Crisis, both overall as well as specific banks? In the post you shared, you mentioned Wells was at 27%. You mentioned U.S. banks at 43.9%. So a little context there would be helpful.
Sure. So there was roughly 35% of the market share in 2005 were adjustable rate mortgages. Now, based on some of the data that's out there, this is what banks are holding in their portfolio. So for those banks, 35, 38.5% are adjustable rate mortgages. Now, that doesn't include all of the different lending types and structures out there. As of, I just posted a couple articles, but as of the end of last year, it looked like roughly 10% of all mortgage applications were for adjustable rate mortgages. But again, we're publishing this data in reverse. And so instead of the whole concept of this was to be able to see, hey, we're not repeating this, right? But if everybody, including the Consumer Finance Bureau, only looks at it in reverse, well, that's not forward looking. You can only go, oh, I guess that last year was terrible. Whoops. You know, but to put that in context, 35% of mortgages in 2005 were adjustable rate mortgages.
I'm going to follow up on his question with something else. And this is for Ozark and Mr. A. Ozark's another one of our longtime participants and has produced some excellent articles. So if you're not on macrowedge.net, get your butt in gear and go to Ozone and sign up for the website and the newsletter. The reality I have a question of is this. Are the financial institution regulators counting the home builder incentives, the 327 variable incentives, as part of the ARM structures?
So temporaries are not actually considered an adjustable rate mortgage. So let's say, for instance, if Lennar were to sell, which is called 50,000 temporary buy downs, those technically aren't being reported as adjustable rates. That information gets reported that it's a temporary. The amount of points paid gets recorded. It should, right? But again, going through this data, I'm finding out a lot of it's not getting reported, and it's not, either it's not being recorded or it's not being reported, one of the two. But the data is missing in the data files. So it's problematic.
This brings the question. Based on that information, because I've seen the buy downs in Southwest Florida, and Tricia, who is another great contributor to the website, will speak to this if she can. What I'm seeing now is that these buy downs by the builders, now – they may or may not be counted as MBS. I'm beginning to think they're using them as asset-backed securities, which is more dangerous on a short-term nature, because if you have a default in the first 2 years, you're talking about impacting financial institutions faster and more severely with less insurance to pay off if there's a failure. Anybody want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's disheartening, I would say, to say the least, given the number of lessons that we could have learned with the last financial crisis and any number of ones that have happened before. I think that in the aggregate, my hope is that X will help to change the conversation about this type of thing, and that we'll have some serious policymakers in place to prevent this in the future. I don't really know a lot of options are on the table to address this type of thing other than some reasonable regulations around the financial system to prevent this type of systemic risk.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, but it's kind of it's like a moving target. I would love if we didn't do this repeatedly, but there's always some form of it going on. I think it accelerated after the great financial crisis, in part because banks were recovering. It really took them from 2008 until about 2014, 2015 to finish the actual foreclosure process. If anybody reads or follows Melody Wright, she has spoken on this quite a bit, but I mean, for certain parts of mortgage banking and for housing, there was a depression. It was not just 2008, 2009. It was on until 2014, 2015. And that kind of opened the door for these non-bank lenders to come in into the lending space. And I don't – how do you do away with that? I know there's discussions about different legislation, but
I think it's a question of letting the market work in a sense, and at the same time, you know, moving away from turning on the printing press every time there's a problem. You know, if we had.
Well, yeah, I'll agree with that 100%. I think that's been terrible. I think the zero interest rate policy was one of the worst decisions that our country's ever made and put us all through, along with the bailouts. You know, and I know that that's a topic that everybody has concerns about, but I would advocate to not do that ever again.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think it ultimately encourages the bad behavior that's resulted in the situation that we're in again. And it's going to continue. But you know, as we've talked about before, particularly privately, regarding the federal budget and the amount of debt, I mean, at some point you have to mean revert, and the math will take care of itself, unfortunately.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm gonna have to disagree with that, guys. I hate to interject here and interrupt you, but I have to disagree.
No, how about it?
The federal government does not have to mean revert. They are the ultimate overseer of all financial systems in the United States. They can change the rules whenever they want, and I think that's the problem. The Fed is accommodating them by guaranteeing that interest rates will remain reasonable for Treasury borrowing, not exactly normal, but reasonable. That's why I don't see rates ever surpassing 6%. I heard it on Bloomberg today. I heard it on CNBC. Oh, my God, what happens if the 10-year tops 6%? It'll never happen in our lifetime. We no longer have a free market in U.S. Treasuries. It is a suppressed yield, which guarantees that the risk factors for the largest, not the smallest, but the largest institutions, is guaranteed to a certain point. Now, if we ever get to 5.5% on a 10-year, yes, I could see some problems. I originally thought we were going to get there. I was listening to Jim Biello. I'm listening to Jim Bianco and lots of other individuals. I just don't see that happening. I think because of the election, we're going to suppress rates and reduce rates to bail out the subprime class of our society. Nothing personal against the poors and the almost poors, but the truth is we can't let financial institutions fail at this point in time. All means will be engaged to guarantee re-election or election of someone favorable to their financial point of view.
Well, I think there's some of what you're saying, John, that it's accurate, particularly about the government changing the rules, and that's typically what they've done is they've changed the rules. I don't think the election really has as much to do with it. We've had election year recessions before. Some of them have been brutal. You know, 1980 comes to mind. That was certainly destructive, especially to American industry. And, you know, the recovery really wasn't much of a recovery, which led to the 81-82 recession, which was devastating to American industry. You know, that really kind of altered the landscape in American history, right? Of American businesses, forestry, sort of the start of outsourcing. So I think to some degree, you're right. There will be rule changes, just like in the Great Financial Crisis, they changed the rules. During the 2020 recession, they changed the rules. They bailed people out, spent money. But it doesn't stop there from being a recession. It doesn't stop there from being consequences. It just stops them from being maybe so much or as bad as they could be or good, depending on how you look at it, right? I think some deflation is good. I think the cost of everything is starting to really have a strain on everybody. But I don't think it's possible to just ignore mathematics or monetary science. If we go to the hyperinflation route, you know, then we have social unrest. Then we've seen what that does in other countries. So it's not necessarily a good thing to go that route either. If they start to attempt to bail, bail out more companies or printing more money.
That's why I'm sort of subscribing to the stagflationary route. I think that we're going to see something similar to 1980, where we're willing to accept a certain degree of inflation. Official inflation. Let me put that in finger quotes for those of you on radio. And we will accept a certain degree of inflation because the impact is not on the largest asset holding class. It's more on the average soul who's trying to work three jobs, survive, make their mortgage payment, get their kids to school, etc. This is not a quote-unquote class warfare lesson for me. Believe me, with that screen name, you know I'm not in that camp. But what I'm looking at from the larger perspective is that the path that our monetary overlords have chosen is something that will create social unrest simply because they're going to say, you can only own property if you're subsidized by the government. You can only buy a car if you're subsidized by the government. And then you have to obey what property, what vehicle, et cetera, they dictate to you. For the upper 40, probably soon to be 35%, you still have the freedoms that we enjoy now. My fear about this is that the social unrest created by this is going to disturb the future plans and economic sustainability of our nation as we go into a private property crisis that no one is willing to address. If only a third of our nation can afford private property, the other two-thirds are going to demand you share.
Well, I mean, I guess you could point to certain cities, right? We just heard Denver is they're basically laying off city employees, closing city services and rededicating money to housing migrants. So, I can see where there's the concern there, but I guess if we go that route, right, if we continue, then it's already no longer the A, that's fiscal policy, not monetary. And B, I mean, that's not really the United States of America anymore. Now we're talking about something much larger, I guess, and whether or not the country continues to exist in the fashion that it always has.
And I think that might be a good jump to maybe the next segment on foreign policy. John, if you want to kick us off with that, then we can take it back over to the three of us.
That sounds good. I'm going to invite everybody else to sit there and request to speak if you wish to. But Ozark wants to bring up the foreign policy aspect of this because despite popular belief, foreign policy, especially monetary policy, impacts our international standing in the world. And if you want to learn more about this, please join up at macroedge.net. Subscribe to the Substack. It is worth your time and money. Take it away, Ozark.
Yeah, no, I mean, Mr. A had a really good point about, you know, questioning whether this is the United States of America anymore, and we still are. It's not about that, but there were four significant shifts in foreign policy this week. There was the Biden administration with the seesawing on the Houthini rebels, that first, you know, we were going to redesignate you as a terror group. Now, if you stop firing missiles, we'll take you off the list. There was Anthony Blinken saying the United States does not support Taiwan as an independent country and, you know, kind of hinting at a potential diplomatic solution there. Then the other big issue that happened was Biden, Washington, whatever you want to call it, permanent Washington, stepping in on Israel and calling for an immediate ceasefire and trying to de-escalate the situation following Israel's airstrike on the Iranian embassy in Syria. Then the fourth major foreign policy shift was Blinken announcing that NATO is open for Ukraine, or Ukraine is going to join NATO. There's some big event. You can read different headlines, come to your own conclusions, or you can read the source. I'll let you come to your own conclusions on that. But ultimately, it looks like there's a seat at the table for Ukraine and NATO. So if you're looking at the chessboard, the United States is trying to buy time in the Pacific. Use distance to buy time like there was in World War II with Japan, and then concentrate on the Russian problem, if you will, at first. Now, what's obvious to most people is that if you signal these types of moves, it makes an attack more likely, or it emboldens your adversaries to move against you because you're showing weakness. And if you also read between the lines a little bit, now, I've seen some commentary. I don't know whether it's true or not. I'm not going to pretend to be a military equipment professional, but some people are alleging part of this backing down with or ordering, trying to get Israel to back down and not escalate is reportedly because there are hypersonic missiles that, and if you know more about this, feel free to add something in the comments, because I'd love to learn more about it. But supposedly there are Iranian hypersonic missiles, potentially Russian ones as well, that can't be intercepted. And this is part of trying to support Western supremacy. I don't know whether that's true or not. I just thought that was an interesting take on it. I don't really know what the tea leaves are from these actions are trying to say, but I think there are some indications there. So it'll be certainly be interesting to see what happens.
Well, I'll give you my background on this. I know the people who were in the military and talked to some of them about this. And the Zircon, which is a surface-to-surface missile, and the Kinzhal, which is a Russian air-to-surface missile, are both hypersonic and have not been intercepted by Ukraine. And the Patriot missile system is totally incapable of taking it out. So the Russians and the Chinese both have it. Reportedly, the North Koreans tested one on Wednesday. No confirmation. It's supposed to be a hypersonic glider warhead. We have no confirmation of that, but that's a dangerous threat to the United States also with their ICBM capabilities. To make matters more interesting, and to be quite honest, Iran is sort of a mystery. We know that they have missiles that can reach Paris, Berlin, etc. We have no idea what their capacities are as far as hitting the United States, because they've never really tested a true satellite of some substantive size that would carry a warhead on top of the rocket. That being said, we're trying to buy time to get more equipment to Israel to help offset any risk from Russia, Syria, and Iran getting involved in a major conflict. At this point in time, Quds is over, which is the last Friday before Ramadan ends, which is Monday night for those of you in the United States. It is a crucial time to watch the next four nights, because if they're going to retaliate against Israel, this is the time. Ozark, I want to throw this out to you as a bigger perspective. The very people who lie to us about our own data are the ones saying China is lying about their data. Who do we believe?
I use your own eyes. I mean, I think it's, as I get older, I kind of think about, all right, when my parents were this age, what year was it? That kind of thing. And you think about the bridge in Baltimore as a good example of our infrastructure overall. So I think it was built in 1968, if I'm late 60s, early 70s. I might be off by a few years.
It was finished in 78, just for your information.
Okay, 78. Okay. I mean, my parents were both teenagers at that point. And I'm thinking, I have kids. They're going to be teenagers pretty soon. How are we still using – are you telling me, and with a serious face, that there hasn't been a call for upgrading our infrastructure or building modernized infrastructure in this country? And I think that that's part of how you have to look at this economic situation between the United States and China both saying the other side is lying, is if you break down the GDP numbers and you try to look at a – 50, 60, 70-year view, 80-year view of the United States, maybe on paper there's more production, but ultimately wars are wars of attrition. We know this from World War I. We know this from World War II. And we know this from that, they can be determined by other things, of course, Vietnam, Afghanistan being good examples. But when you're fighting a peer or even a near-peer adversary, you need to be able to attrite them to the point that you win. This was Western history doesn't discuss it a lot, but that's what happened on the Eastern Front in World War II, and the Allies basically came in to prevent the Soviet Union from spreading all the way probably to the Atlantic Ocean. And when you start to look at things that way and realize that the Cold War, you look at the history that the Soviet Union was a near peer. It was never, other than the nuclear apocalypse, it was never a true military threat. Most NATO publications, if you go through the history, that the United States always had the significant upper hand in military affairs because of our industrial capacity and because of our ability to produce and allocate resources and capital efficiently, and with the free, transparent transparency of information. We improved as a country. We were able to talk about crises and problems, and that's what's made the, I think, fundamentally what has made the American experience work. And when you have a government that lies about statistics, lies about the reasons for doing things, is not transparent, and, you know, blow, for example, and just makes incredibly poor decisions of the resources it's given, which would of course include the use of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve as a midterm election fund. And now we're in a, as an economy, we know, I think we've talked about the consumer debt situation quite a bit earlier. We've talked about the risk in the credit markets, and you can start to see a lot of risks piling up that, again, going back to what a little bit of what we kicked off on, talking about the markets, is I don't know that there's an appropriate way to evaluate this type of risk where if you have a real change in the global order. I mean, what happens to pharmaceuticals if all of a sudden they're getting paid printed United States dollars, they can't pay a dividend anymore? What happens to their valuation? And suddenly the rest of the world has to either comply with intellectual property laws, or there's a new solution, or what if that just doesn't happen? And what so-called innovation in drugs ends? I mean, these are serious issues that we kind of take for granted with how our current system is set up, based on that power, ability to project power, that economic growth, that, you know, real fist that's behind the United States of America. And that's what's concerning about the concept of a war of attrition. You know, in a graduate level class, you know, there was a conversation about China, and people said, well, they have this huge surplus male population, they can't do anything. And I'm thinking, like, what are you guys talking about? That is the surplus male populations are what creates revolutions. No revolution has been won by men over 35 years of age. And China, to an extent, you know, just by the sheer numbers of it, that's always going to be a risk for their society. And they have their own internal domestic economic issues right now related to the credit markets too. So I would say, this is why I don't predict what's going to happen, because there are so many different variables that I just don't know we've taken into consideration, and particularly to your point, especially for the reasons I just listed, John, especially economic numbers and GDP.
Okay, thank you, Ozark. I want to throw this out for everybody to consider, because this is very important. One thing that's different is that everyone assumes that the Chinese system is identical to ours. If you've talked to people who have been there, worked there, or had commercial relations there, it is a totally unique system. I can't speak to it because I've never been there, never been invited to China, only dealt with people in Taiwan. Needless to say, that limits my ability to sit there and interpret it through a neutral lens. But one of the things you have to remember is their banking system is structured where the ultimate bank is the PBOC. So if Joe Blow's regional bank in a small village fails, the losses aren't incurred simply by the people. They're incurred by the state, and the state can print that away. This is where I think they have a unique system that, yes, Jay Powell is very jealous of in that regard, but from the bigger perspective, we are not allowed to compete fairly with them because of their ability to dilute, inflate, or deflate their currency at will. Folks, I'm going to open this up to everybody else. Ozark, take over, please.
I don't know what's going to happen. Like I said, I don't predict what's going to happen. I can just look at the information on the table. And in China's an interesting case because it's clear that if you start to look at the deep details of some of their consumer data, they still haven't recovered from COVID, not even close. I think their peak automotive sales was clearly 2019, and it's been on a downward trend ever since. You can start to look at, you know, some of the very real stress in their banking system. So it in a sense, it creates an incentive for them to be disruptive and distract from the domestic disaster and point outwardly towards particularly Taiwan. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. Like I said before, you know, kind of alluding to the Soviet Union, is that I think one of the things that I really appreciate about this group and quite a few of our followers that I can see here as well who engage in the discussion is that there is a free flow of information, but it's where you need to go out and ultimately gather it and analyze it yourself. And our policymakers, unfortunately, they've ended up in this feedback loop of, you know, financial system controlling the messaging on, you know, call it CNBC, whatever you want to call your mainstream network of choice. I remember the last meltdown very well, because I was in college at the time, and there were, up until the market had really corrected going into the election, when the stock market finally started to take a nosedive, into weeks before, you had the talking heads saying the market was fine, the administration was saying the market was fine, the Federal Reserve, the entire confidence game was going until the ocean goes out slowly and then all at once. And it looks like the United States and China might be in a little bit of a game of chicken in that regard to see who can play that extended pretend game that Mr. A had referred to as well earlier.
Well,
I'm going to just second what you said there, too. I think that's important that everybody does their own research and looks for sources that are putting in reality.
Amen. Don't take our words for it. Please do your own research. And to be honest, in 2008, I have to admit, in October, I was out fishing when Lehman Brothers failed. It was great to watch on, satellite. The Caribbean was beautiful then. Okay, folks. Let's go ahead and open this up to anybody who's a listener. If you wish to speak, please put a request through in the spaces. You just had to put a request through. We'll put you on the air. We want to have this discussion as open to as many opinions as possible. The reason being, we don't want to sit there and just tell you what we think. You can read that. You can subscribe to it. But if you have a question or an opinion, please put a request in to be a speaker. We are more than happy to sit there and address it as much as possible to the best of our ability. This entire program will be available as an MP3 for those of you who tuned in late. If you missed the first part of the program, we will download it. It'll be available on my blog. It'll be available on Macro Edge. We are going to sit there and start setting this up as a regular MP3 podcast, for lack of a better term, for everyone to listen to at their own convenience. Kenny, you need to speak up. Moving on. And the last part of the program that I wanted to address until we get some calls or some listeners who want to speak up, we have a situation that has developed where credit scores are falling. Oh, there we got our first request. And it is, lost Ozark there for a minute. We're seeing a decline in credit quality across the board. This all ties back into what is happening now with markets, with financials, with the ability of our system to function normally. And Mr. A, Ozark, on the broader picture of things, if credit quality is declining, I mean, I'm going to read the headline from the New York Post. Credit scores fall for the first time in a decade as Americans struggle to pay their bills. If Americans are struggling to pay their bills, does this not mean that we're going to start seeing selective defaults based on the economic conditions in regions and certain classes of the economy, which are just not able to survive despite working two or three jobs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's almost, it's not a household that is almost a micro corporation in a sense, where if your business is starting to lose money, you're not cash flow positive, you're going to make selective decisions about where to cut. It might not be a bill, it might not be a debt obligation, because you'll lose the company, but you know, it'll be employees, it'll be benefits, that type of thing. And you can almost see that in some of the more recent earnings reports talking about subscriber numbers and churn, where there certainly are a lot of consumers out there that are making decisions about where to cut their spend, and that continues to happen. And it goes, and again, it kind of speaks to that macroeconomic risk. If you think about back in the GFC where the slowdown began, and what pushed everything over the edge is that the slowdown began in Southwest Florida in the marginal communities that were a 45-minute drive to the jobs, And those were the consumers that got buried first, who were truly living on the margin of the urban area. They lived there because drive until you qualify. Big quote for those who might not remember, big kind of phrase from our commission 6% salesman back in that era. And they're at the margins, and the same thing will ultimately happen again. That's kind of, I think, where you've heard some conversation recently about black swan type events. Well, that to the credit markets and what happened back in the years leading up to the GFC, that increase in gas prices in the summer of, is that 2007? There was the 2005 spike from Katrina. I think it was 2007, the summer 2007. That was what ultimately pushed that foreclosure, ended the era of drive until you qualify, pushed up the consumer stress. That's ultimately what kicked things off last time. And I think it's probably going to be similar this time as well, but it could end up being any number of things. It could be the slow squeeze of inflation. It could be a black swan style event. But ultimately the consumer is going to mean revert as far as their finances go. And I guess we'll just see what happens.
So Ozark, go ahead, Mr. M. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just going to add that I shared the last time the FICO scores went down was 2007, 2008, and 2009. So I put that in the comments for everybody through the graph.
Ozark, I got to tell you, and you, Mr. A, the funny thing is what he just described was Lehigh Acres and Northport, Florida, in Southwest Florida. Lehigh Acres was supposed to be this great suburbia. It was a hick town, for lack of a better term. That was an agricultural center feeding out towards Immokalee. Northport was the great new bedroom community south of Sarasota, where people could drive an hour, hour and a half to work and have a good time doing it in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And here we are now, full cycle, 15 years later, repeating the same thing with the same communities, and there are still vacant properties, lots, and houses, incompleted properties, I should say, existing in those areas. What's your take on that, guys? Why aren't we refurbishing the old stuff and making it new?
Is the American way as far as home building goes. It's the same type of towns, the same type of areas, drive till you qualify. That came from driving out of the city, driving out past the first ring suburbs, then the second ring suburbs, then the third ring suburbs, until you could qualify to buy a house, because that's where builders get cheap land, is out in the middle of nowhere. They buy farmer's acreage, turn it into a subdivision, and before too long, it's a suburb.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that that's been a big component of the American dream. That is only made possible by massive infrastructure projects to build highways, to keep traffic flowing so that it's possible. I mean, with DFW being probably the best example of it, is that that is ultimately what our economic archetype is intended to move towards. And that kind of goes back to what I was alluding to earlier, I think, with the infrastructure spending and the lack of investment. You know, my grandfather was a civil engineer in the Northeast, and his first project, and again, this goes back to this infrastructure conversation, his first project was that first ring road around Boston that was built, called Route 128. Now it's Interstate 95. They, at the time, were upgrading it to full interstate standards in the mid to late 50s in alignment with the Interstate Highway Act. And they expanded bridges that were two lanes in some sections. They went to three lanes each side on the others, and they left space for building a fourth lane. Well, you can drive over those bridges today, and they still don't have that fourth lane. And you can see, in a sense, to an extent, what the impact has been on that real estate market in Metro Boston and a lot of other areas that stopped investing in infrastructure.
I'm going to throw into this. Yeah, no. Go ahead, Mr. A. Sorry.
Well, it's okay. I just wanted to give kind of a brief answer to your why don't we reinvest in the areas that need it. You know, we've got cities like Detroit that there's lots of empty real estate. And that's just the easy example, but you can find it in Pittsburgh, you can find it in St. Louis. You go across Texas, and you will find entire towns that are basically vacant. And all you gotta do is drive across the country and find it. But ultimately, if population is leaving those places, it's pretty limited in what you can do to, you know, give that away because there's less people.
So what you're saying is the National Association of Realtors is molding policy to fit the new communities and really doesn't want to sell the old communities because there's not as much profit. But with that, I'll leave that go. That's my chief shot at realtors tonight because I'm going to tell somebody, everybody, something honest. I have a hippie aunt who's in her 70s, and back during the 08 crisis, and when I say hippie aunt, I mean full weed, full acid, the whole nine yards, Woodstock, the whole nine, everything. And her goal, since her days of programming were long over, was, you know what? Money is short. Oddly, to become a realtor. That's when I knew that bubble peaked. Right now in Southwest Florida, we have more realtors per capita for every home than you could ever imagine, every property than you could ever imagine. And I'm hoping to get some people on that will speak to this fact, because it's a nationwide issue. It's not a local or regional issue. It's nationwide. And that's why I think a credit crisis is building and going to cause major issues. Guys, we're going to wrap it up tonight. Folks, if you're listening, please feel free in the future to speak up. We're going to try and keep this short, sweet to an hour. We want to sit there and make this an easy podcast to listen to. You don't want to hear me bloviate. I'd rather listen to you guys ask questions and talk about it. I appreciate everybody who participated tonight. I will say this. Pay attention to what is happening in markets after next week. That's when the reality hits as earnings begin to occur and roll in. Watch gold. Gold and silver are sending a signal. There's no faith in what our government is doing. This is a risk factor, not based on just geopolitical problems. It's also based on a loss of faith in our nation's ability to manage its affairs. Oil is also a third rail. No one wants to talk about it. Watch Brent, watch WTI, watch what happens in the next 2 weeks. Meanwhile, please go to macroedge.net, subscribe to the Substack, join up, get a hold of Ozone. You want real-time data that will sit there and provide all of our listeners the live data you can't get through the mainstream media. That is the best source available, in my opinion, outside of what is occurring now. For Macro Edge Radio After Dark, I wish to tell you all good night, and we will see you next Friday night at 9 p.m. with a new edition, Macro Edge After Dark.